Quick note here, I've been on the road a bit, which has meant less than ideal recording conditions. So at times in this episode, my audio is not great. I'm sorry about that, and I do have a solution, so it won't happen again. But in the meantime, thanks for your patience. Okay, back to the show. Hello, and welcome to AgTech So What. I'm Sarah Nolette. When it comes to the Wild West world of tech, policy can often feel a bit besides the point, a thing to be ignored completely in the best of times and skirted or unwillingly dealt with in the worst. But for farmers, the story is a little different. And to navigate ag policy, ag often depends on advocacy groups.
You do need to be able to come together and lobby the government, if not to get the outcomes that you necessarily want, to mitigate some of the disasters that can happen by just a legislative stroke of the pen.
That's Emma Germano, president of the Victorian Farmers Federation and managing director of her family's fresh produce farm. Emma spent her childhood on the family farm, learning about business and finance before taking a leap to university and eventually into buying and running her own restaurant with the backing of the family farm. This first foray into entrepreneurship was a painful experiment that taught Emma many lessons and led to new opportunities consulting for and advising other small businesses. But when Emma's dad challenged her to bring her learnings back to the farm, she decided to return to their diversified specialty crop operation that she grew up on, and she was surprised by how much she enjoyed spearheading the business aspects of the farm.
Really loving the negotiation and the vegetable market, like literally being up at 4 a.m. in the morning because, I don't know, prices are going up or prices are going down or whatever, and just screaming bloody murder down the phone at wholesalers and the culture of that. I really enjoyed it. I do say now though that I've pulled out of the horticulture stuff, and it's because I've had basically an argument with every wholesaler that's left in Australia. I could never really accept the asymmetry of power in the relationships between wholesalers and growers. And that has started to change a bit, but back then it was just like, you're a grower. And to the point about dad, I think that the cauliflowers are worth 40, but I'm getting paid 20. And I just could never bear it. Even when they were like, don't worry about it, like you're still making good money, or why do you have to have an argument? So anyway, I quite enjoyed that.
This sense of entrepreneurship that Emma got to experience on the farm was just the beginning. Shortly after returning, Emma got the chance to go on a growers tour, which started her down the path to advocacy.
I'd gone off on that first growers tour with AusVeg. And so all of a sudden, same story, like, oh, young female, quick, let's take a photo of her and prove that we're a diverse industry. So it chased me, as in the advocacy life chased me. From there, I did a Nuffield scholarship. And when I was on that first tour, the AusVeg tour, and it was a woman's tour. And I think that now that I reflect on it, I realized that I said yes to it because it probably felt like a safer space because it was women. So it was like, oh, you're allowed to be here in this tour and whatever. And someone on the tour said to me, oh, there's this thing called a Nuffield scholarship and you have a study topic and you get 30 grand and you've got to do, what is it, 16 weeks of overseas travel. And I was like, wow, you know, like one day, that's what I was thinking. Now they talk about like the difference between men and women is that men will have a crack at a job when they've got 60% of the attributes that they need and women wait till they've got 120%. I'm more like a man in that. I'm just like, I will just have a crack because the worst thing that can happen is that I don't get it, which will either tell me that I no longer want it or it'll make me better to get it the next time. So the very next year I heard about Nuffield being advertised and I was like, I'm just going to do that. That way I'll go through the process. I'll go through the interviews. I'll know what the question is. And then when I'm ready in a few years' time, it'll increase my chances of getting it.
Emma got the Nuffield scholarship. And when she returned from her overseas travel, she was not only convinced of the importance of food security and the issues facing global ag, she also identified more as a farmer than ever before. And the travel and research helped shape Emma's vision for the future of Australian agriculture, which led her to both an AgTech idea and the Victorian Farmers Federation.
So I had a little tap on the shoulder because I'd been noticed when I was doing Nuffield and why don't you come and see what we're doing, and there might be a position in the horticulture group. And okay, so I'd only just started to be like, oh, what's a VFF? And then the backpack attacks thing happened. And at that point in time, to the point about this is when I'm trying to build the ag tech solution, because trying to get workers on my farm was an absolute nightmare. I had moved to using backpackers away from the white van of Asians model that dad had been using, because that's just what we did. And then to go beyond that and start doing your own payroll and recruitment and whatever, it was actually like really difficult on the farm. And so I'm doing this task now manually, and I'm on my trip overseas using Uber and using Airbnb and starting to understand, if I had this tool, but for farm workers, like that would be so easy. That would make my life so much easier because it's taken me 2 hours to induct every staff member. And then the backpack attacks saga started. I get a phone call. Oh, Emma, we're just wondering if you would do one radio program. And she literally said, staff member at the VFF, I promise it will only be one. I don't know how many radio interviews I've done since today. But because it was a real story, like I didn't have to manufacture anything. I have the backpackers on my farm. I can tell you everything about it. That was how it started. And what I realized is that it doesn't matter whether or not I go off and work out how to connect these dots together to build this thing, or if my dad's the best cauliflower grower on the planet, or we do everything perfectly, or the price is high, or whatever, that a government decision, a policy decision, or a legislative decision can be the difference between success and failure on the farm. And that was when I understood the power of advocacy and why it's actually really important. And I looked at the VFF not as something like, oh, I just can't wait to be part of the way that it is now. I looked at the VFF in regards to literally its balance sheet, its history, its legacy. Even though a lot of these organizations started to feel old-fashioned, what I look at it and see is something that my generation of farmers absolutely need. You do need to be able to come together and lobby the government at the, if not to get the outcomes that you necessarily want, to mitigate some of the disasters that can happen by just a legislative stroke of the pen. And also the sense of we're coming together in this sense of community and unity. And I think that there is just simply some kind of intangible power in that coming together of people.
So what do you think the future looks like for these organizations? You mentioned the kind of old world or old ways we've done it traditionally. When you think about advocacy moving forward and attracting more young people and thinking about technology, obviously the political landscape is changing too. What's exciting? What do you think needs to happen?
We were talking about how the newer generations coming in are better at collaborating. I think that will change the way that we do advocacy. There is still so many agricultural advocacy organizations in Australia, way too many. And what it does is dilute, I think, the message, dilute that connection that I was talking about. And it becomes about egos and logos. From what I can see, there's a lot of impractical stuff. And it's just like that because it's always been like that. And then you end up with two people, one in this organization, one in that organization, and they just simply don't want to agree with each other because, not necessarily because it's right or wrong. I think that there needs to be a bit of a concentration of all those groups because the farmers can only continue to financially sustain a certain number of them. Having said that, a quick calculation of the balance sheet of all of these organizations together, we're talking literally more than $600 million that farmers have invested into these organizations. Well, I would ask, do we get out of these organizations an adequate return on that investment?
This point really got me thinking. And I wonder what farmers and others in the industry think about this prompt. Do you think that membership dues or other funds that you and farmers you know pay to advocacy organizations make a return? If so, is it adequate compared to the investment? Do some groups offer a better return than others? Or is ROI not really the driver behind advocacy? I'm curious to hear what you think, so let us know. Emma went on to discuss not only what value groups like hers offer to current members, but also how they're appealing to future members, particularly those from younger generations.
The other thing that's really interesting is that there was this mentality that, oh, young people don't want to go to branch meetings anymore and they want to do everything on social media and whatever. And I went out to Longrenong College at the beginning of my presidency and was addressing actually there were first, second and third year students in there. And I was saying to them, we're setting at the VFF right now our climate change policy. So it's going through this process in order for us to have a policy on climate change. Who cares about that? Of course, they all care about it. And the new generation care about it in a manner that will connect with it as like natives, perhaps more than the older generations that maybe have a different, more pragmatic approach to, if we reduce all of our emissions here in Australia, is it going to make any difference? And I remember when that river flooded 500 years ago, so whatever, it's not a thing. There is a difference in mentality, definitely. And I'm not saying that all old people don't care about climate change. That's not what I'm saying. But I said to these young people, if you're not at the table helping us formulate that policy, we will be formulating policies right now. We will be doing advocacy right now that will affect how you are going to farm in 10 years and in 20 years time, because parameters will be put in place, legislation will be put in place, carbon credits will be put in place. And if you're not at the table, you're just going to be dealing with the product of whatever it is that we achieve right now. And everyone was like, oh shit, like maybe we actually need to get involved in this thing, but how? And so then I said to them, would you go to a Zoom meeting to have a branch meeting? and put your hand up. And no one put their hand up. And I was like, see, you young people, you just don't care. And then I said, if we had a function at a pub, would you go? And of course they all put their hands up, right? Young people want to connect and be social. And that's not just young people, that's all people. But we've spent this time doing this old school, let's have a town hall debate and let's move the minutes and let's do it like this. And that rigid structure, I think, is difficult to engage with, and people want less of that, but they care as much, if not more, about the issue.
You've touched on this a few times, Emma, and you, I guess, have made a bit of a name for yourself around like being a person who's unwilling to accept tradition for the sake of tradition. Like it's kind of a theme here. Where do you think that comes from?
Definitely my parents. Like we were, both myself and my sister were always encouraged and validated when we actually stood out, actually, I think, and not stood out in a way like for the point of attention. In fact, my mother spent a lot of my childhood trying to be like, Emma, you can't argue with the adults. And I remember where there was like a dinner party at our house, and I must have been about 10, and one of my dad's friends, and we're talking about the three states of like H2O, like water, steam, and ice. And I was like, it's all H2O. It's all the same chemical product. And he was arguing that, and he was like, no, that's not true. And I was like, it is true. And I was getting really quite worked up as the 10-year-old. And my mum came to me and she said, I want you to go in the other room now. And I was like, why? And she said, because it's disrespectful for you to be having that argument. And I was like, what do you mean? He's wrong. Like, he's just simply wrong. So on one hand, mum was trying to be like, don't argue with everybody all of the time. But I kind of just came out a little bit like that. But it's not for the sake of conflict. I just think that people should communicate and be truthful and honest. That is, when I say my parents and my aunties and uncles, if you come to Easter with our family, you have to be thick skinned. Like you're not going to survive Easter if you're going to be precious about it. So for me, being really robust in communication is not for the purpose of trying to overwhelm other people. It's just this way my family talk. And when we did things like stood up to bullies on behalf of other people, that was when my dad would be like, well done. And we just went through a court case with the Farmers Federation. And I don't know the answer as to whether we've won or lost that case or whatever. But I said to my dad, everybody is saying that it's because I'm aggressive, Dad. And if I was a man, they wouldn't say I was being aggressive. They're saying that I'm aggressive and that I'm pushing. And that the case is about us terminating a member because the board believed that member to be a bully. And we had enough evidence to suggest that he had conducted some bullying kind of behavior. And I said, and now it's not even about me. I'm trying to defend somebody else. I don't care. I don't have an agenda against this person or whatever, but we have to have some values because this is why people don't join the organization. They don't want to be in an organization like this anymore where we fight amongst ourselves. But they call me a bully and they say this and that. And literally when I ended up in the witness box, I was called a slut shamer actually. And it was put to me that I'm in fact a bully. And I thought that's unbelievable. Like that really, it gets me on a personal level because actually I can't stand bullying and I would advocate for anybody. And that again comes back to that's the way that we were raised. And I get really frustrated at the people. Yesterday, there was a group email situation. And of course, Emma says some inconvenient truth on the group email. And then people individually start responding to me. Oh, I'm so glad you said that. And it's, don't tell me you're glad I said it. Put it back in the group email. Everybody should be saying it because we just need to have more robust conversations. It's not the purpose of me being the disruptor. Like I didn't come here as the disruptor. I didn't even know I was coming into this space.
When you get typecast like that, then it's, you almost have to keep not performing, but like it puts this pressure to be almost inauthentic in your authenticity. Like I think that can be really tough. So yeah, a tough line to walk.
That's really eloquent what you just said there. Because it is me, but it's not me all of the time. And there's more nuance than that. But if that's the thing that people first react to and that's what they want. And I think that sometimes it becomes detrimental to me because then I feel like people think I just do it for the sake of it. And I never do it for the sake of it. And I'm actually quite introverted and quite socially awkward, in fact. And people never realize that. I'm sure that it would sound like I'm being disingenuous. But for me to rock up to a networking event or whatever, my biggest fear is that, oh, people are going to think that I'm really full of myself because of being typecast as that particular person all of the time. Like they must think that it's because I'm really full of myself and I'm not. Like I'd rather stand in the corner. I can perform when it's time to do the thing, but everybody's got their light and shade and their insecurities as well. And I think that can get lost.
My conversation with Emma shifted gears here to focus more on what she thinks the future might look like. starting with the future of her farm.
When the pandemic hit, I remember driving back to the farm for the first time, like when lockdown was starting, and I was like, I'm obviously going to do lockdown at the farm, and just having this renewed sense of pride is not the right answer, connection and absolute gratitude for the fact that I had that farm in that moment. I was like, I'm so blessed. If we're, like, when the world is literally going to go to shit, however it does, that I have this safe space that is food security, literally for my own family, really meant something different to me. And then spending nearly full time there for 2 years, I have ended up with this emotional connection to the land like my dad has, in a different way than how my dad has. But certainly when I first entered the industry, and I would say things like, oh, the problem with you farmers is that you are connected to your land, so you make bad business decisions. But without that connection, I don't know that agriculture will be able to sustain itself in quite the same way. I believe that there is something in the food production, in the growing, in that connection. And I would describe it as, and I know not everybody's religious, but it's like a partnership with God or the universe, right? Like, you are literally like working with the weather, the this, the that, the other. And what's the future going to be? Probably less of that. There'll be more vertical farming. There'll be more things that are just computerized. There will be more things that are grown in substrate instead of soil. I think that might be to the detriment of human health, to be honest. I think we're already seeing a shift away from a focus on nutrition in food, and particularly in rich nations. We go, oh, let's make sure that there's 6 different colors of tomatoes in this wonderful little punnet of blah, blah, blah. But we don't look at it and go, how many vitamins and minerals are in there? It's not part of the consideration. Hopefully we'll start having that conversation. And when we talk about food security, we actually need to have nutritional security as well. It's not just about having bulk of food to make your stomach full. So I think we'll see more of that. I think that there will inevitably be geopolitical circumstances that shift the way food is traded across the globe. And it'll be interesting to see how Australia fits in to that space. I think if you said 20 years time, and when I first started Nuffield, the question was, how do we feed the 9 billion by 2050? And that was a really great question to start with. But now what I look at is, there are literally starving people right now. We are degrading the planet right now. The food system, the way that it is right now, isn't actually sustainable. For everything that we advocate for, and we say we're doing all the right things, and we are, but there's such a bigger context to, are we doing the right thing? Of course, like, I advocate for open markets and sending the mangoes from Australia to the UK under a free trade agreement. And that's great. But actually, is that going to be to the detriment of more starving people? We're seeing food shortages in Australia right now that I think will change the conversation. We will be doing ecological services, I think, as part of our farming enterprise mix. And I think that's a great thing.
She also offered her perspective on what she sees in the future for the VFF.
VFF will be doing whatever it needs to do to help in that circumstance that maybe I just described. Maybe it'll be rolled into some kind of Australian farmer model where we're less parochial around our states and where we come from. I hope that there's some kind of referendum where we get rid of one level of government, which might have an impact. Could that happen in the next 20 years? Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. But I think it's interesting because everybody always thinks it's the worst that it's ever been, but it certainly does feel like things are getting faster and faster and faster now. Like, we can have a global financial crisis 1 minute, but because of how fast the globe is now, you can recover from it a lot quicker. So it'll be really interesting to see how it transpires.
In addition to her work on the farm and at VFF, Emma has also experimented in ag tech, in particular working on an app to address labor issues. The app is still in the lab, so to speak. So I wanted to talk with Emma about perceptions around ag tech among farmers and her experience of pushing for innovation in the ag policy sphere.
There's something cultural about it, and this sense of self-determination almost. And it is a really strong vibe in the farming community. There's an example, actually, just even in the Farmers Federation. There's a particular issue that we have been advocating or lobbying government for a long time. And I actually asked one of the staff for a proper briefing, because I'm like, why are we banging on about this? We're really burning quite a lot of political capital here. And what we're asking for, is it even achievable? Can someone brief me? Because I hate saying the lines when I don't even know the thing. I said, if you were the premier of the state, to the staff member, would you do this project? And she said, no, I wouldn't. And I said, why are we asking for it then? And she said, just because we have been, because we've always been, because we decided at some point in time that was the right thing. And now we're just being proud about the fact that the government should care about the farmers. And I was like, that's not a reason to lobby for something. And I see it even in my the relationship between me and my dad on our farm. Like sometimes I'm like, I think dad just says no to me just because that's the correct answer for him in his mind. The first answer is always no. It doesn't matter. You know, so I've like, even from a really young age, have tried to work out how the best way to get the most out of my dad, or the best way to manipulate dad. Dad, if I told you that something was going to cost this much money, is that fine? He'd be like, whoa, absolutely not. And then, oh, okay, it's half that amount. Oh, okay. You know, that kind of thing. The frustration that I have with ag tech, that we, and there's nothing wrong with talking a big game, and there's nothing wrong with being excited about it, but there is so much more excitement about it than what's actually happening. And then there's these really basic practical barriers as to why we're not developing more, why we're not adopting more, why technology is not being built, the Internet of Things is not being built faster. No, no, everyone will say, oh, there's a huge explosion. But again, in regards to what's tangible and what you can use on your farm, there's not that many great products. And I just think it's really difficult because there's almost like two mentalities. When I was building the platform for farm workers, and I still haven't finished that. And it's really interesting because I think that when I first started, I was like, oh, I've got to go because there's all these competitors coming to the space and I'm going to miss my opportunity and whatever else. And what's interesting is that from conception, I suppose, it's been, I don't know, 6 years, maybe. Yeah, like 5 or 6 years. And actually the problem has become more acute. The solution is needed more than ever. The way that I envisage the product that I was attempting to build, no one's built it in this way. And like, there's this notion of build as you go and start with one really great feature and then build as you go and be dynamic. And it's just, that's great. And I understand that this is a new mentality about how you build and develop a thing, whether or not it's a technological thing. But the world almost, or business almost, doesn't work like that. People don't have time in their business to cock about with you while you're trying to develop something and, oh, which feature do you like best? And let's go back out and ask our market what they love and blah, blah, blah. There does have to be some level of, this is complete to this point and this is helpful. But of course, that takes a lot of money to do. And then there's all of these people talking about like incubators and investors and venture capitalists, and everybody's like talking about it, but actually the number of dots that actually connect with each other and how much investment money goes into ag tech startup in this country is, it's actually a really small amount. And then it all usually comes with a bunch of conditions, and all of a sudden your investor who's pumped about it because it's almost that ag virtue signaling. A lot of people who are investing in it are not in ag, and it's just the buzzword and the thing to do. And then all of a sudden, because they're passionate about it, which is great, they're then trying to direct the way that you would be building something rather than just letting a farmer. And I think that my generation of farmers and younger than me are where all of this stuff is going to come from, because we're practically on the farm and we know the problem that we actually have and we know the solution that we need. And if we can build that and allow that to be leveraged out for other people, that's great. And for me, it was literally just like, I have this problem on my farm and I need this solution on my farm. And every single season when I'm employing my workers, I'm still like, oh my God, I absolutely need that thing that I started and then obviously got sidetracked and busy doing other things and priorities changed. But it frustrates me, because I think if there had been a stronger ecosystem at the time when I was building it, I would be in a totally different position now. I'd probably be up to version whatever, and it could be something that would be helping me on my farm and helping other farmers. And I find that frustrating. So it's like all of the dots between the conversation and the aspiration, which is awesome, and I'm not trying to take away from that, but how do you actually make it practical? And I think there's all of these connectors, and it's that connection between different industries and different organizations, and whether it's producers and government or producers and tertiary education or whatever, universities, like how do we create all of those dots?
They're not easy problems to solve. There's two tensions there that you highlight, Emma, that I think about a lot. One is the, if you're a startup in this space, however much ag background you have or don't have, you've got to tell almost one story to investors about the, like, you're painting this picture of the future that doesn't yet exist and getting them on board with it. And then to your customers, it's, I totally get that I'm at version 0.01 and it's going to be shit for you, but I'm going to build it up and spend my time and my money to help make this better for you. And yes, I need a bit of your blood, sweat, and tears too. And here's the benefit, but just being really honest about that. And those are like two really different conversations. Yeah. I think the other one is that a lot of these farmers, and we see this all the time, have awesome ideas. Like, you're out there feeling that challenge every year and going, why doesn't the solution exists. We see it all the time. And yet the, it's, what did you say, 6 years, like you're busy running a farm, you're busy helping build the industry. Like you're not going to build a software product. There's just too many other things on your priority list. So how do you bring in those well-incentivized, well-intentioned, right skill set people to come take those ideas forward? And it's a tough conversation because you don't want to just tell someone your all your ideas and give them all your IP and have them build it, right?
So I always thought to myself, anyone can build the thing that I can build, but I have a profile around this particular problem. And that's the bit that I have to leverage when I start going to investors and telling them, oh, this is what I'm going to do and this is how I'm going to build it. Because the actual, in fact, the solution already exists. It's multiple products out there that exist that just need to come together in a manner that has a great way of operating for the purpose of a farm. It's just as simple as that. And without the farmers, you can't get that. You have to have the farmers as part of that piece because they're the ones with the problem and they're the ones that have got to be able to apply whatever solution to the problem that they have on farm. And there was like everybody's got so much advice for you. And I was like, I don't need advice. I literally just need money. And someone asked me at a networking event the other day, oh, what happened to your product? And it's like, oh, it feels like a fail. And I said, I'm not done with it yet. And I just know that that's the case. Like I still am not done with it yet. And it was seriously more about needing the solution than trying to become rich on an ag tech product. It wasn't about me or owning the product or building the product. It was actually just about I need the product.
Emma's experience in the ag policy space, whether on her own farm, traveling for her Nuffield scholarship, or serving as the president of the VFF, has taught her some powerful lessons. And I had a few reflections in hearing these. First, I think Emma's perspective on the future of advocacy groups in ag is fascinating. Looking at ag organizations from an outside perspective, farmers in Australia and elsewhere have invested a lot of money and other resources in these groups. So it makes sense to me that they push hard to ensure there's a meaningful return. I'm curious, though, how these returns are defined and on what timeline. I do think Emma's prediction that these groups will feel increased pressure to consolidate is correct. I also appreciated Emma's efforts to grapple with what she's learned in business and in policy. I love that she recognizes that the question, how to feed 9 million people by 2050, might be an interesting one and good in some marketing slogans, but that it's not more relevant than the fact that we're already struggling to feed people in Australia and abroad here in 2022. And it's not a question of amount anymore, but rather things like nutrition, logistics, and politics. I also appreciate that Emma recognizes the contradictions that are sometimes inherent in promoting global trade and supply chains while also pursuing climate and social goals. This recognition, I think, is an important step in working towards improving these systems. Finally, I didn't necessarily agree with some of the lessons Emma's learned in her explorations of ag tech, though I appreciate that there's a lot of room for nuance here. To me, the idea that entrepreneurs don't have time in their businesses to share their products with current and prospective customers to gain feedback and iterate is a bit of a faulty one. But it's one that makes sense if you're trying to both farm full-time, be the president of an active political organization, and work on an ag tech project simultaneously. There's definitely a real skill to balancing customer wants and needs with the business capacity to meet them. And I get it. It's totally different if you're building a product for your own use case, where you, of course, know your problems versus building something for customers who may have different needs than you do. In this latter case, whether it helps shape the product immediately or not, getting that user feedback is crucial. So that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. Thanks to our guest, Emma Germano, president of the Victorian Farmers Federation. And of course, thank you for listening and for bearing with my audio quality. For more information on some of the resources mentioned in this podcast, please visit our website, agtechsowhat.com. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time.